"You hypocrite." Those are words that strike fear and anger and even trepidation in the hearts of every believer. Sometimes those around us in our culture will point at believers and accuse them as if all were guilty of such a thing. Jesus had those in his day he was having to deal with as well, who actually were guilty of hypocrisy. And as we study together in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, it's important for us to realize that part of what Jesus is doing as he teaches this sermon is to deal with the sin of hypocrisy. He's laying down the foundation of what those who will be a part of his kingdom will be like. And they are not to be hypocrites. His audience was made up of many good and sincere people who sincerely wanted to be right with God. But some in his audience also had slipped into a practice that by all accounts could only be described as hypocritical religion. And as we look together at that this morning, it very much frames the particular part of the Sermon on the Mount we'll be looking at. We look together in Matthew chapter 5, and we hear Jesus saying in verse 20, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Jesus, using some modern parlance here, is calling out not some little fringe group of people that everyone looked down upon and already knew were not in a right relationship with God and didn't even make a pretense of it. He's not talking to the tax collectors. He's not talking to the prostitutes. He's not talking to those who were of the Herodian thinking or the Hellenist thinking who really weren't even committed to God anymore. He instead picks out those who were at the very top of the religious hierarchy among the Jewish people. And he says to his people that unless they live better than those people are living, that they can't even be a part of God's kingdom. This is not how you win friends and influence people. Using the expression from a few decades ago when salespeople and others were often taught how to be influential in business and so forth. But Jesus isn't trying here to win their friendship. He is not trying to cater to them so that they will like him. He's trying to challenge them, and more than just them, he's trying to challenge all the people to see what is really happening. Those same people, those Pharisees and teachers of the law, were actually accusing Jesus from very early on of trying to set aside the law that they had received from Moses. And he keeps reminding them that in fact it was they who were setting aside the law, even though they were the ones who claimed that they were keeping the law. They had created a sort of scarecrow version of the law given by Moses, and then that's what they kept. But the real law given by God through Moses that was started with the Ten Commandments and then was built upon with many other laws regulating not only their relationship with God, but their relationship with each other. Jesus says that the true purpose of that law, the true fulfillment of that law, is found in what I'm teaching you now. He said, "I did not come," according to chapter 5 and verse 17, "I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it." We looked a few weeks ago about all the many different ways in which Jesus was fulfilling the law. But one of those ways was he was helping them understand how the law could accomplish its purpose. That is, why God gave the law. It wasn't just so they could have a set of rules and regulations. It wasn't just so they could have ceremonies to keep. It was so that they could truly be the people God wanted them to be, from the inside out. And so almost everything about the Sermon on the Mount is addressing this topic of inside out. And the practice of the religious leaders of their day, and we can't say that for every single one of them, but apparently the dominant characteristic of many of these people was that of living hypocritically, according to Jesus. We hear him in other places in the scriptures talking about, for example, Luke chapter 12 and verse 1, he tells his own followers, he says, "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees." And his own disciples are talking to each other and says, what is he talking about? They had just seen Jesus a few days before feed 5,000 people with just a few loaves of bread. So they're trying to think, okay, yeast, bread. He must be talking somehow about the miracle he did. And he says, don't you see? I'm talking about the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And just like yeast, it is pervasive. It will work all the way through everything a person does. Hypocrisy. In another place, he will say in Mark chapter 7 and in verse 6, he will say to those people, you honor God with your lips, but your heart is far from him. And then again, later in the Sermon on the Mount, over in chapter 7, he will say in verses 1 through 5, he will talk about not judging others because God will hold you to the same standard you're trying to hold others to. He will talk about trying to get a speck of sawdust. And I think here Jesus is actually drawing from his own experience growing up in a carpenter shop. He said, here you are trying to get a speck of sawdust out of your brother's eye. And I have to think that, you know, the scriptures tell us Jesus had a number of brothers as well as sisters growing up. And so all of them no doubt helped, especially all the boys, helped their dad in the carpenter shop as long as Joseph lived. And so one of your brothers gets sawdust in his eye. And so you're over there trying to get that little bit of sawdust out of his eye. And look, you've got a whole beam, a whole large board sticking out of your eye. And Jesus says to those people that he was so concerned about, he said in 7:5, you hypocrite. So what is a hypocrite? We've mentioned this before. The English word, hypocrite, according to the online Merriam-Webster dictionary, is a person who acts in contradiction to his or her stated beliefs or feelings. So someone who claims to believe something, claims to be a practitioner of something, but their actions contradict that. That's the fundamental meaning of it. It's interesting that the word hypocrite is not a translation of the Greek word in our New Testament. Instead, the word hypocrite is right out of the Greek. The Greek word is hypocritis, hypocritis. And it's just transliterated over into English, just like a number of other words like baptize and so forth. And in the Greek, the word hypocritis originally meant someone who was an interpreter or who gave the meaning to something. Someone who spoke over against. In other words, if you literally think of someone who was speaking in a language other than the Greek language. But here's a person who both knows that language as well as knows Greek. And so they stand there, and as this person speaks, then they tell the meaning to the audience, whether it's the king or whoever. They're an interpreter. They're a translator. And that was actually the original fundamental meaning of hypocritis. But gradually over time, it sort of lost that meaning as it took on more and more the meaning of someone who is saying something or doing something that isn't really them. You see the connection with the original because the translator isn't speaking out of his own heart, is he? He's not speaking his own words. He's speaking this other person's words. He may be totally different than what he's saying, but he's just an interpreter. Well, gradually that concept came more and more to mean someone who was saying something or doing something that wasn't really them, a hypocrite. The Greeks were great lovers of theater and plays, and therefore they had actors who played parts. And they even used this word hypocritis to describe the actor. That was one of the Greek words for actor, was hypocritis. He is playing a part. He is not what he pretends to be on stage. When he gets off the stage, he might be a carpenter or a merchant or something else. But on the stage, he may be playing a king or he may be playing a slave. He's a hypocrite. He's an actor. But then that spread out into everyday life, where people were pretending to be things that they were not in fact. And Jesus uses that concept. And he's the one almost exclusively in the New Testament who uses the word. Over and over, he refers to those who are hypocrites. But he's not just talking about their outward actions. It was also a matter of their heart. We will see as we go along that their outward actions were often hypocritical as well. For example, they would, as we studied 2 weeks ago, they knew the law said, thou shalt not kill, but they wanted to kill Jesus. They knew the law said, thou shalt not kill. But if someone both disagreed with them and was disagreeable enough over a long enough period of time, they seemed to be able to manipulate their court system to have this person found guilty of something and killed. They were literally hypocrites in a very physical way with that particular commandment. But it went beyond that. There were many more people that they just hated. They couldn't kill them, but they hated them, and in their heart they had already killed them. And Jesus says that's also hypocrisy. And the true purpose of God's law in saying thou shalt not kill was not just to prevent people from beating each other over the head with a rock or stabbing each other with a sword, but God's true intention in giving that commandment, thou shalt not kill, was to deal with the heart of a person, the root of where murder came from, the heart. And now he turns, starting in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 27, from the commandment that said thou shalt not kill to the next commandment in the Ten Commandments that said, thou shalt not commit adultery. You know, Jesus didn't just start with the little kind of niggling things that people might sometimes let slip in their lives. He just jumps right in to some of the most significant things. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Then he will, as a part of that one, go on, as we will have to talk about next week, about divorce, which was a part of committing adultery. He'll talk about their lying after that. He will talk about their treatment of those who they consider their enemies. He's going after big, obvious things in people's lives here. And particularly these commandments like thou shalt not murder was a capital crime under the law of Moses. In other words, if you were found guilty of murder, you were put to death. But if you were found guilty of adultery, that was also a capital crime. And you were supposed to be put to death if guilty of. It would be a mistake, of course, for us to think that it's only when Jesus comes along that God suddenly became interested in what was going on in the heart of a person, even on this topic. And in the passage that was read for us at the beginning by Don, in Job chapter 31, considered by many the oldest book in the Bible, thought to have been written before Genesis. Now, of course, Genesis talks about things that are older because it talks about creation. But it's thought that Job probably was actually written even earlier than the books of Moses. In this oldest, we think, book in the Bible, we hear this man Job, who was a righteous man and tried to live right before God, saying this in Job 31, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. For what is man's lot from God above? His heritage from the Almighty on high. Is it not ruin for the wicked, disaster for those who do wrong? Does he not see my ways and count my every step? Here this true patriarch of the Old Testament knew that standing right before God when it came to this topic was not just a matter of the outward action or lack of it. It started with the heart. And he said he had made a covenant with his eyes. Covenants are things that are made not to be broken. Usually covenants were lifelong. And Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. Why? He said, because this is what we can expect from God. He punishes us for our wrong and blesses us when we do right. Unfortunately, we have a very amply illustrated picture of this in the story of David, a man who overall is described as a man after God's own heart, And yet a man who at times did things that was very wrong. And so in 2 Samuel chapter 11, we have this story of this man that God had made king, who as he sent his army off to war, he stays home. And I'm not to judge whether he should have gone or not. Some thinks that that was the beginning of the problem right there, that he wasn't doing his job as king. He just sent others off to do it. But regardless of that, it says in 2 Samuel 11 and 1, in the spring at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. Their housing over there was built with flat roofs, and often in the cool of the evening and even at night in the summertime, families would often sleep on the roof of their houses because they didn't have central heat and air conditioning and even fans. It'd be much cooler and more comfortable up there. So in the cool of the evening, he's walking on the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. From his elevated height, the palace was probably a couple of stories tall. He could look down into the city all around him in the evening, and here in a compound nearby with no doubt a fence around it where normally a person would have all sorts of privacy, here is a woman taking a bath. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. And the man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. And we know that's not even the end. He committed adultery with her. Adultery is when at least one of two people are already in a covenant relationship of marriage with another person, and yet these two people have sexual relations with each other. That's the definition of adultery. David commits adultery with this woman. In this case, they're both married to someone. He has several wives. She has one wife. She has one husband, a man who's a prominent member of David's army. But he commits adultery with her. And then to hide the sin, whenever it's discovered she's now pregnant, he arranges to have this officer in his army put into such a position during a battle that he's killed. It was all a contrived incident to make sure the man gets killed. And then when the child is born, it does not survive. It dies. If David had made a covenant with his eyes not to look lustfully upon another woman, he broke that covenant. He definitely broke the covenant he had made before God to be faithful to his own wife, and had forced this woman to break her covenant as well. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 27, "You have heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery.'" And that's what the law said. They had heard it correctly. That's what it said. But what was God getting at when he gave that law? "But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Jesus says it's not just the act. It's the heart that precedes it that God is looking at and judging. You know, these people he was trying to deal with, these who were so opposed to what he was about, we can read all sorts of things about what they did and what he had to say to them. But Jesus actually accused them of being guilty of adultery. First of all, guilty of adultery in the sense that they lusted after women. You know, that every man struggles with that practically. So they were no different, and Jesus knew that. But the problem was they didn't stop just as unintended, perhaps, opportunities were presented to them. They followed that through in their mind, Jesus says. So they were guilty of adultery in their heart, but they were also guilty of adultery in another way. They were guilty of adultery in that they, spiritually, in their covenant relationship with God, served other things, just like their ancestors had. We've been studying on Sunday morning in the book of Jeremiah, who lived 600 years before this time, that the people of Jeremiah's day were guilty of spiritual adultery. They were supposed to be in a covenant relationship with God, But they had entered into intimate spiritual relationship with the idols and worshiped other gods. Now, the people in Jesus' day were not so much worshiping other gods in the classic sense that they were worshiping something made out of wood or stone that looked like some kind of an image, but instead they had made other things their god, like their money and their property and their pride and their position. And they'd put that above God. But yes, I believe Jesus even accused many of them of being guilty of physical adultery as well. They had found ways with many of these laws they claimed to be keeping. They found loopholes. They actually passed new laws that gave them ways around doing what the law actually said while still claiming they were keeping it. We're familiar with the story of the woman taken in the act of adultery in John chapter 8. And not all translations of our New Testament have it there, because some of the early manuscripts we have of the Gospel of John does not have it there, or has it in a different place in John or whatever. But nevertheless, here's this story where they bring this woman to Jesus, probably still in her nightclothes or even scarcely clothed at all perhaps. And they tell Jesus, "Master, we caught this woman in the very act of adultery. What shall we do with her?" Well, they knew, and they knew that Jesus knew what the law said, that someone taken in the act of adultery should be stoned to death. But you know, there's a few things odd about that story. Where's the guy? Where's the man? Why only the woman? Both, according to the law, are to be put to death. Whenever they present this, what they thought was a dilemma to Jesus, because they knew he was compassionate and merciful, intended to forgive people, which they claim he didn't have the power to do. When they bring her to Jesus, Jesus stoops down and begins to write something in the dirt, the sand. And while we don't know what he wrote, I suspect they did. But then at last he raises up and says, "Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone." And I realize that usually we just think that he was saying that anyone here who's without any sin at all, cast the first stone. In other words, if you've never lied, if you've never coveted your neighbor's property, if you've never fudged on your taxes, or, you know, we usually think of it that way. But I want to suggest to you that you think about something else. I just wonder if Jesus is not saying, which one of you is not guilty of adultery? You cast the first stone. For many of them had found ways, as we'll see next week when we study divorce, they had found ways to actually divorce their wives and go marry someone else they wanted to be married to. And Jesus says, the way you're doing it is adultery. I suspect many of those present there, Jesus was actually convicting of adultery, and not just in their heart either. And they one by one leave until no one is left, starting with the oldest. They were guilty, at least in their heart, and many of them in their spiritual lives, and some of them in physical action, were guilty of the very thing they claimed to be upholding and wanted everybody to look up to them as being staunch, obedient servants of the law. And yet they were guilty of breaking it and pretending that they were not guilty. They were hypocrites. But how does Jesus say his disciples, his followers, ought to deal with this? With whatever it takes to stop it. For he goes on to say in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 29, "If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell." I think it's pretty interesting that he picked the two parts of our bodies that he did. As near as I can figure out, probably the two most prominent senses we have that would be involved in adultery are vision and touch. Don't you think? I think hearing to a lesser degree, but then tasting and smelling would be way down the list of involvement most directly in leading someone into such a sin. But like Job said, it starts with the eyes in many cases. At some point along the way, the hand's going to get involved. Touch. Well, this isn't a counseling session for young people or anybody else about how to stay away from sexual sin. these are the things that will get you into it, will lead to this. So Jesus uses what's called hyperbole. Hyperbole, according to a Bible dictionary, one of my favorites by a fellow named E.W. Bullinger on figures of speech used in the Bible, he says, hyperbole is when more is said than is literally meant. Exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. We do that all the time in our language too. Hyperbole is not unique to the language Jesus spoke. We have it in our language all the time. We have little expressions we say so often we don't even realize them. We'll say we're scared to death. Hey, you're still alive. How'd that happen? Because that's hyperbole. We overstate it. We exaggerate to emphasize how frightened we were. Our teenagers come in and say, I want to go to this party. Everybody's going. Oh, really? How many's in your high school? Well, not everybody's literally going. But it's hyperbole. And many, many such instances. Many examples in the Scripture, even of Jesus using hyperbole. Hyperbole is not misstating truth. It's just using illustrations to emphasize truth. And so I talk about, for example, if someone causes one of these little ones to stumble, it would be better for them if they had a millstone tied around their neck and be cast into the midst of the sea. That's hyperbole. Don't think we have a single example where anyone ever had that happen to them. Or he'll even talk about, unless someone hates father and mother, brother and sister, husband and or mate and children, that they're not worthy of being his disciples. That's hyperbole. Emphasizing. Exaggerating for the sake of emphasizing. And so here, the solution is not to cut your eye out or to cut your hand off. Sadly, some in the early centuries of the church thought that that was the solution to dealing with sin. And so we see good-hearted, devoted people who would live for years in the desert by themselves or shut themselves up into what later came to be called monasteries and convents. And even some men, some famous early men in the history of Christianity, would literally have themselves castrated trying to deal with the sin of lust. And yet, as one of them said, even after going through all that, living in a cave for years, having himself mutilated to try to deal with the problem, he said, even in his mind at night, he still saw the naked dance. He realized that after all of that, he still had not subjected his heart to deal with the sin. So Jesus is telling us we need to deal radically, but not so much literally physically, with what our eyes do and our hands do to deal with this sin. It's not enough just to deal with the outward and say, well, I never slept with a woman, or maybe redefine even that in such a way that you can say it with a straight face, whether you're the President of the United States or anybody else. It's more than just the outward act Jesus is dealing with. It's what goes on in the heart. We make that commitment. Like Job says, we make that covenant with our eyes. And our world is assaulting us in a way probably greater than in the lifetime of any of us, with all sorts of visions, whether it's in books or movies or advertising or whatever it is, with everything that pushes people in this direction. But we have to have this covenant with our eyes and our hands and our heart, that we will not go down that path. We will be faithful to the covenant we have with our God, and we'll be faithful with the covenant, if we're married, that we have with our mate, to not be guilty of the sin of adultery. Jesus was hard on sin, but he also came to die so people could have forgiveness of just such sins as this. And that's what was so terrible about the Pharisees and the teachers of the law in his day. Not only were they guilty of the same kind of sins everybody else was and were hypocritical about it, but then they rejected the means that God provided so they could have forgiveness of it. We are not like them. We can have forgiveness of sin.